Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. For the record, the date is April 5, 2006. The time is 1:32 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm here on behalf of Secretary of State Gigi Dennis. To my right is Jason Dunn, Deputy Attorney General, who is the designee of the Attorney General, John Southers. And Mr. Dunn will not participate in agenda item number 3, which is rehearing on number 86. To my left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. Mr. Carton will be sitting as the Director's designee for the first 3 agenda items. And then, by the way, the 4th agenda item, number 87, that measure has been withdrawn by the proponents. So we will not have a rehearing on number 87. For the last agenda item, number 93, the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services will be Sharon Eubanks, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. To my far left is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Title Setting Board. To my far right is Ceci Gomez from the Secretary of State's office. For anybody who wishes to testify, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the back door. The hearing is broadcast over the Internet from the Secretary of State's website, and it's also a recorded formal meeting. Let me talk a little bit about the procedures that the Board follows. They're basically, for each new measure, there's basically 3 steps that the Board goes through. First, it's important to make sure that the Board understands each measure. So I'll provide an opportunity for the members of the Board to ask questions of the proponents just to make sure that we understand the measure. The next step is for the Board to determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title for the measure, and that necessarily involves deciding at least one question, and that is whether the proposed measure complies with the single subject requirement of the Constitution. If the Board determines that it does have jurisdiction to set a title, then the third step is for the Board to work on titles for the measure. The Board will work from staff-prepared drafts, which are on the table by the back door. I do want to emphasize one thing. The Board is not concerned with the merits of any proposal. It really comes down to 2 questions. Does the measure comply with the single subject requirement? And if so, what are proper and fair titles for the measure? Generally, we take testimony first. A decision is reached by 2 of the 3 members of the Board. And then anybody who's dissatisfied with the decision of the Board is or may file a motion for rehearing within 7 days of today. With that, let me turn to the first agenda item, which is 2005-2006 number 90. Term limits on Court of Appeals and Supreme Court judges. And as I indicated, I'd first like to hear from the proponents, and we'll see. We've had versions of this before. Probably one of the questions that might be helpful to have addressed is how this differs from previous versions. But Senator Andrews, are you here? If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I am John Andrews. My organization is called Backbone Issue Committee, and initiative number 90 concerning terms of office and term limits for appellate judges is in fact a variation of what you've seen before and set title for it, which was number 75. 2 principal differences would be that the status of incumbents as of the presumed date of enactment next January is made more clear in number 90. That clarification being that they would stand for retention at the date of the next general election if eligible for another term at that level, at court level. The other thing that is clarified is that 10 years total service at a particular appellate court level is the maximum, and that interacts with the other provision that I just described, so that judges or justices to whom that 10 years of service would apply as of next January 1st would be effectively term limited after the 2008 general election. There was also a question raised on number 75 in regard to one court level. I believe that I don't have the old language in front of me, but the question was raised as to whether we had inadvertently encompassed all judges with a term limit. That was never the intention, and I believe that the drafting is tighter here to make it clear that this only applies to the Colorado Court of Appeals and the Colorado Supreme Court.
Thank you. Are there questions of Senator Andrews? If not, let's turn to the question of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify with respect to the single subject question on this measure? Seeing none, I'll turn to board discussion. We've previously determined that predecessor versions do comply with the single subject amendment, single subject requirement. Any discussion from the board? Mr. Carton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, as you said, number 90 appears to be closely modeled after its predecessor, number 75, which the board found a single subject for. And I believe that with the changes that Senator Andrews has described in version number 90, that the measure still encompasses a single subject, which, jumping a little bit ahead, I think is accurately reflected in the staff draft of the title.
Would you like to offer a motion?
I move that the title board find that the title board has jurisdiction, that measure number 90 has a single subject, and that the title board has jurisdiction to set a title for initiative number 90.
Second. That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff draft of the titles. I think Ceci will display it on the screen in the room, so that everyone can follow along.
Mr. Dunn? Mr. Chairman, one question for the proponent. I don't think you addressed this in your comments. Existing judges or currently serving judges and justices who have 10 years in office will be out upon enactment or upon January 1? Or what is the exact date?
The intent, Mr. Dunn, is that their term would run until after the 2008 general election, and I think that intent is evident because the proposed amendment language is silent as to any other result. All it says, you see, is in the final sentence of the new Section 27, is that someone who has served 10 years or more at one appellate court level shall not be eligible for another term at that level. It doesn't say that their term ends as of January 1st.
Okay, so would it end upon the term they're currently serving?
It ends upon the next general election, and then however the current constitutional language operates to whatever it is, the second Tuesday in January after the next general. So actually, it's going to go to January 2009 in the case of an imaginary Judge Jones that has had 10 years next January.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Let me, and maybe you really are already addressing this, but in the middle of the text of Section 27, well, the second sentence says incumbents As of January 1, 2007, she'll stand for retention at the next general election, so that would be 2008, I think. And it says, if eligible for another term at that level. Now, why would they not, you know, I assume they, the only reason why they wouldn't be eligible would be if
that would be by the operation of the 10-year provision.
Okay. So on November of 2008, if anybody has served 10, or, well, if they would serve 10, well, I'm not sure how to say it. I'll let you take a stab at that.
Well, my imaginary judge, Judge Jones, that took office in 1996, would be covered by the final sentence of Section 27, and so that judge's term would end in January 2009 because there would be no eligibility to have stood for retention to another term, and having not been retained, that judge is term limited.
So, and maybe I'm being dense here, but as a practical matter, somebody who has, let's say, served 6 years as of November 2008, well, say 7 years, would not be eligible for another four-year term. Is that correct? Because that would put them over the 10-year limit.
Well, you're presenting me with a new situation. Let me work my way through it.
Okay.
I would say that any judge or justice who has served even one day less than 10 years is eligible for retention to what, a 4-year term at the 2008 general election, because the ineligibility is not prospectively triggered by will have served more than 10 years. It is triggered by that if you have served more than 10 years, you're not eligible to stand for retention.
Okay.
So somebody that served 9 years and 51 weeks as of the 2008 general election is still eligible to stand for another 4-year term.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask one clarifying question on that. It says on that second sentence, incumbents as of that date shall stand for retention, blah, 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 if eligible for another term at that level. So is it eligibility as of January 1, 2007 or January 1, 2008? I believe you answered his question as referring to 2008, the 10-year timeline being 2008. Or is it January 1, 2007?
No. January 1, 2007 only speaks to the incumbency, defining who is an incumbent.
Okay.
The operation of the 10-year provision, intention of proponents is that it operates as of the general election of 2008.
Any other questions? Well, let's turn to the staff draft. Senator Andrews, have you had a chance to look at the staff draft, and do you have any comments?
I've looked at it, Mr. Chairman, and all of my unfortunate instincts to play with text, coming from being both a legislator and an editor, came up empty. I think it is fine as it's written.
And again, I don't have anybody else signed up to testify, but let me know if there is somebody else who wishes to testify on the titles for this measure. Let me turn then to board discussion. Any discussion by the board with respect to the draft, the staff drafts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it would be in the nature of a question. The staff draft on lines 2 and 3, starting with providing, it states providing 4-year terms of office for justices of the Supreme Court and judges of the Court of Appeals. And the text of Initiative 90, Section 27, now speaks to terms of offices for appeals court judges and Supreme Court justices. And I note that appeals court judges is a change from the terminology used in Initiative Number 75, which was Court of Appeals. And so what I'm wondering is whether or not on line 3, I guess it may be first it would be a question of whether appeals court judges in the text of the measure means judges of the Court of Appeals.
That was our intention. Mr. Carton, I don't really think it's susceptible to any other interpretation than that, since we only have one Colorado Court of Appeals.
And there are no other appellate court judges other than the Court of Appeals and the Colorado Supreme Court. Thank you.
So, I guess following up on that, I guess the question then is, you know, is it fair enough for the draft titles to refer to Court of Appeals? And it sounds like it probably is, although it's supplying some words that aren't in the measure, but I don't think
I have. As I said, it's entirely agreeable to the proponents.
And let me move on to maybe a little different question. I guess I'm wondering about line 4 in the staff draft. In the clause that says requiring appellate judges serving on January 1, 2007 to stand for retention of the next general election, I'm wondering if it's worthwhile to include the qualifier if eligible for another term at that level, because some may not be. As I understand it, may not be eligible for another term if they've served 10 years. I just don't, and I don't know whether that's a detail or not. Senator Andrews, do you have any comment about that? Do you see that as being significant?
I don't think so, because as our colloquy already established, the restriction on line 6 and 7 of the proposed title stands as a qualifier back to line 4, whether you put that language in line 4 or not.
Okay. Any further discussion about the staffed draft?
Mr. Chairman?
Done.
We had a discussion last time on number 75 about the use of the phrase term limits, whether or not that was a catchphrase. And I think it was a point of litigation in that case, or is a point of litigation in that case, that we should probably address it. I think our consensus last time was that it was not a catchphrase, and I would support that again. I'd like to get that on the record that while I think it's a commonly used phrase, I'm not sure it meets the legal definition of a catchphrase and that it incites voters to vote one way or another.
Mr. Kneiser, would you want to comment on that? Do you have any advice for the board?
Right. We had argued in the brief we just filed this week that it is not a catchphrase. You know, the only issue I think for the board is whether or not they would want to eliminate that as a possible issue on future appeals.
I think I'm okay with it. I understand we had the discussion. I think I can see both sides, but I think today I think I'm okay with the phrase. But
I am as well, and I kind of concur with Mr. Dunn's reasoning.
If there's no other discussion, is there a motion? I'll take a stab at it. I'll move that the board adopt the staff draft as the titles for number 90.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0, and that concludes action on number 90. The time is 1:52 p.m. Thank you, Senator Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Board.
I also hate to make somebody else do the motions. don't have anybody signed up for the next measure, so I'm surely there is somebody here to sign up for number 80. Anybody here representing proponents or opponents or anybody else on number 80?
Why don't we just put it off to later on the agenda?
We'll skip over number 80 since we don't seem to have anybody here right now, and we'll come back to it later in the day. Let's move then to the next item on the board's agenda. This is 2005-2006, number 86, compensation for land use regs that diminish value. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing. For the record, the time is 1:54 p.m. I'd like to first hear from representatives of the motion for rehearing. Mr. Gruskin, are you representing? If you'll identify yourself for the record, please, and we do have your written motion for rehearing, but if you want to highlight the things that you would like for the board to especially focus on, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm with the law firm of Isaacson Rosenbaum, PC, and our firm represents the movements behind the motion for rehearing. As indicated, Mr. Chair, you have my written motion. There are some things that, upon reflection, I guess I would have liked to have stated somewhat differently, so I'd like to take this opportunity to do that. There are 10 specific grounds listed in the motion, and I've been brief in the motion so that I could be a little bit expansive here, but the first one, it seems to me, may have been an oversight, but it is an important oversight. The title currently reads that the ballot measure in question, number 86, applies. In fairness, Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
Let me just ask whether or not it's appropriate. I know that the proponents aren't here. Do you want to proceed notwithstanding?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's been up duly noticed, and
I understand. I
appreciate you bringing that up. It's true. I don't have anyone else signed up, and I don't believe the proponents are present.
Okay.
Thank you.
The ballot title in question reads that it is a measure that would require just compensation if a public entity enacts land use regulations that reduce the value any portion of property by 20% or more. In fact, the new subsection 2 to Article 2, Section 15 says if a public entity enacts or enforces any land use regulation. And it seems to me that or enforces is pretty critical language. What it signals is that this measure is going to apply not just to newly enacted land use regulations as defined in the measure. And it seems to me that omission is misleading, and I would go on, but I don't think I really need to. Secondly, just compensation is a term of art used primarily in eminent domain litigation, and it has a meaning that is frankly unrelated to the meaning set out here. And this is one of those instances where, upon reflection, it occurs to me that while I got the issue right, I didn't provide you enough detail. Consider this issue. If you take a look at the initiative, the definitional section, subsection C begins as used in this subsection 2, and then goes on to define several terms, including just compensation. Well, that is notable because what is now subsection 1, what has always been the entire paragraph of Article 2, Section 15, includes in the first sentence the following: private property shall not be taken or damaged for public or private use without just compensation. So this measure creates not just a new definition of just compensation, but a new and specialized definition of just compensation that is different from what applies under subparagraph 1. Why is that important? Well, the Supreme Court has said as recently as 2004 that just compensation as used under Article 2, Section 15 is not merely a cash payment for a diminution in value. Just compensation anticipates that the condemning authority and ultimately a court, if it has to address the matter, will take into consideration the reduction in fair market value and then consider what the court calls special benefits. Let me read to you from the Supreme Court's own case, because I think they explain it better than I do. This is the E-470 Public Highway Authority versus Rebenig case cited at 91 Pacific 3rd, 1038. The example the court gives is as follows. When part of a landowner's property is condemned for a highway project, the results to the landowner are a detriment in the form of a taking of property, and in some cases a benefit in the form of the increased value of the remaining property. These offsetting consequences to separate parcels arise from a single transaction, the highway project. In addition, these offsetting consequences accrue to a single landowner. And the court says, basically, just compensation under Article 2, Section 15 was that reduction in value offset by whatever benefits are attributable to the particular taking in question. Well, this definition of just compensation is extraordinarily different. This definition of just compensation only takes into account the first half of the court's equation, that is, the reduction in value. And therefore, anyone reading the term just compensation would presume that it is used as a term of art and that it means what it has always meant, and that would be incorrect. And it seems to me the title cannot set up a new standard for just compensation without relating what that standard is and how different it is from the existing standard. Third, it seems to me that there was cause to use the phrase just compensation, and it's not just because it's wording in the initiative, but compensation that is just necessarily means that if it wasn't being done in the way it was being done, it would be unjust. And it seems to me that when you promote something as either just or not being unjust, then you're necessarily trying to appeal to the voters' sense of emotions here. So if it is not a term of art, and if you disagree there, it seems to me this is necessarily a catchphrase, because just compensation does not truly describe what this measure, in fact, does under the definition. In the same regard, the introductory clause setting forth the single subject statement includes the phrase remedies. And remedies are only important when a legal wrong is done. And what we're talking about here is not a legal wrong, but an application of legal standards that may have well pre-existed the passage of this initiative. And it seems to me that remedies is not appropriate and is, in fact, prejudicial. Arguments 5 and 6 are actually very similar to what I've laid out to you in regards to just compensation. Land use regulation, the court has noted very often, is a local matter. It's a matter for cities and counties and appropriate political subdivisions to take into consideration. But this is an exceedingly broad type of measure that includes public entities that would include the state of Colorado, any state agency, and a variety of local entities that don't engage in land use regulation as we know it: school districts, service authorities, law enforcement authorities, housing authorities, and all special districts, every single kind. It seems to me that where the title talks about public entities engaged in land use regulation, voters could not know that the state of Colorado is going to be subjected to that same standard. They could not know that their local police department is going to be subjected to that same standard. They could not know that their local school district is going to be subjected to that same standard. And it seems to me that without that level of specificity, this title, the vague reference to public entities, is necessarily problematic. Similarly, land use regulation, the word regulation has, again, as a term of art, it has a meaning. It means it anticipates a regulatory process whereby there is an enactment, there is a legislative enactment. But the phrase land use regulation is not used in that regard here. It applies to guidelines, enforcement actions, deed restrictions, and any action taken in connection with an application or permit. Well, it is absolutely the right of the proponents to include that language, but it's the duty of the title board to reflect it in the title, because one could not know, and this is not a detail, that land use regulation anticipates that where an existing administrative process is used, that this choice, either exemption from the regulation or a payment to the landowner, is going to be invoked. And that seems to me to be problematic. Number seven on my hit parade is the fact that this is retroactive for all land use regulations, however that term is defined, since 1970. One would have no idea that regulations and administrative actions going back more than three decades are affected by this measure. And it seems to me that that is necessarily a fact that voters ought to know. Additionally, there are certain types of land use regulations that would not be subject to this measure under its terms. Nuisances, those necessary to protect health and safety, or comply with federal law. Voters need to know that too. These are not insignificant or rarely used exceptions. These are things that people need to know about. Number nine is particularly important, although it doesn't appear to be so necessarily from my motion because it's such a brief reference, or from the initiative itself. But the initiative states quite clearly that the public entity engaged in land use regulation cannot establish one of those exceptions. There is no act by which they may establish the exception. The only way that the exception gets absolutely established under the initiative is by an appellate court from which there is no further review. And it seems to me that voters are used to their land use agencies establishing whether or not a particular measure falls within one of these three categories. And they will no longer be able to do that with any legal effect, not any more than you or I. And therefore, it seems to me that the title needs to say that the capacity of land use regulatory agencies, as defined here, is changed in a significant way. And then as a corollary to that, it seems to me that the title should also reflect that it is only a court of law that ultimately establishes whether or not one of these exceptions exists, that there is no presumption any longer of regularity or correctness. There is no deference given in the legal process to the acts of the local or of any public entity engaged in land use regulation. Well, I don't have anything beyond that, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take your questions at them.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Gruskin? Mr. Garden?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gruskin, on item number five, trying to understand your argument a little bit better. It's my understanding that you're arguing that under this newly created standard for a public entity, that by putting public entity in the title and only the term public entity, that the voters won't know or could not know all of the various public entities that will be subject to the provisions of the measure. And I guess my question would be, you think that the voters currently have more or less an understanding of what governmental units or public entities, which of those units or entities are subject to the eminent domain provisions of the state constitution?
Mr. Cardin, I think the court has recognized time and time again that land use regulation is inherently a local matter. By using the term land use regulation, the message that is sent is that this is essentially an issue between you and your city council. And the court has acknowledged that basically you have the right to presume that because there are inherent rights relative to zoning and other types of land use regulations that occur at the local level. At no point, if this were a measure that was couched in terms of eminent domain, I might agree with you that it's not quite as important that it be that the title be specific, that the state and the police department are affected. But those aren't entities that engage in land use regulation, which is what this applies to. Now, this may have a corollary, this may be a corollary to eminent domain. It's why it's under Article 2, Section 15. But if it really were just limited to eminent domain, and as we know it, then in my view, frankly, you wouldn't create a whole subsection with its own definitions. I don't think this is limited to eminent domain. And I think if the title is crafted that way, then I think inherently you've understated the effect of the initiative for the voters. I share your problem. If this were just eminent domain, I think we'd be okay. But this is eminent domain plus.
That's helpful to me. I appreciate that. I guess my follow-up question would be, again, on objection number 5. Is it your argument that the title of the measure should list each of those governmental units that's included within the definition of a public entity?
Well, I think that the board could get away if it says the state of Colorado, not necessarily listing any agency or department of state government. I think that's probably okay. I'm not looking to expand this title and make it unwieldy, but it seems to me that any entity that falls outside what is traditionally associated with land use regulation, it will come as a dramatic surprise to voters unless the title relates it.
And again, my last question on that would be, and I'm not as versed in this subject matter as you, but you're stating affirmatively that some of these governmental units that are listed currently do not have this type of authority relative to land use regulation. You mentioned school districts, special districts.
Based on the kind of land use regulation that you and I and voters think of, the answer is no. They may have the capacity, which is why I said I think the phrase land use regulation needs to be amplified. They may be perceived as having a certain capacity in that regard. But if you stick with the phrase land use regulation, then there's no way that people would know that the breadth of that term.
Thank you.
Well, while we're on, I guess, number 5 and number 6, I'm still struggling with that. I mean, I'm not quite sure I'm persuaded yet, at least. I mean, the way I understand your argument, Mr. Gruskin, is that the expectation of a lot of people, a lot of knowledgeable people, is that land use regulation means something fairly specific that's done by local governments, counties primarily, and yet the measure, does describe public entities. Land use regulation and defines it broadly, and public entities is not a narrow term. I mean, I didn't go back and find them, but the state of Colorado does have statutes that deal with land planning. I don't know, I'm trying to figure out, you know, in my mind whether people think of that as land use regulation, but I think that's that it covers that subject about planning on mostly on the part of local governments, but I believe those statutes are some of those statutes are probably regulatory in nature and probably would be accurately described as land use regulation. In any event, part of what I'm struggling with is on the one hand, I understand that maybe the expectations of many people might be a little different here, and yet at the same time, how far does the board go in trying to overcome those expectations if those expectations may be jumping to conclusions? I'm not articulating it very well, but it's in my mind it may be more something for the Blue Book or for the arguments for people to understand that that it's a broader measure than traditional local land use regulation by local governments. But the titles are pretty accurate as drafted by the board at this point. So help me understand a little better.
Well, let me point to another case where I differed with the board. We took it to the Supreme Court. There was an initiative a few years back where a proponent wanted to change petition procedures, undo the single subject requirement, and limit the right of referendum on zoning matters. In that case, I know the site offhand, but it was number 43, court said zoning is such a fundamentally local issue that when you change the rights associated with that kind of decision making, you necessarily are doing something that's substantive and not procedural, and therefore it necessarily is independent of the subject of the petition procedures. Well, if that local zoning capacity and the right of people to be a part of it is identified as a local matter of substance, it seems to me hard to think of land use regulation, which zoning is typified with, but obviously land use regulation is limited to zoning, as anything but a local matter. And to the extent that the title isn't clearer about what land use regulation is, I mean, let me make a suggestion. I think if you amplified what land use regulation was and then talked about all state, public, local, district, public entities, you would probably be informing voters of the kinds of things they need to know. But absent, because as I said before, I'm not looking to expand this title and make it unwieldy, but I would like it to be informative. And as to your point about the Blue Book, I agree that the Blue Book can be a source of information, but that is handled by a different branch. It's handled at a different time. And unfortunately, it's handled after petitions have been circulated. And so if you're hoping that the legislature will clarify that, you're necessarily presuming that the petition signers can do without that information. I think that maybe is where we part.
Okay. Let me back up. Just to help me think through some of these arguments that you've made, let me kind of go through them one by one. I think I agree with you on paragraph number one. Unless there's something I'm overlooking, it seems to me that the board needs to amend the titles to reflect your concern in paragraph number one. Number two, I'm not sure I agree, although maybe there's an easy fix anyway. Let me just make the argument on the other side of this. The fact that this particular measure is drafted as additional language for Article 2, Section 2, Article 2, Section 15, may be somewhat happenstance. I mean, it's more than that, but it's somewhat different. The subject is a little different than what's currently in Section 15. It seems to me this measure could have been placed somewhere else, could have been a standalone section or even possibly in another article, but the fact that the proponents chose to add it to an existing section that used the phrase just compensation seems to create tends to contribute to the argument there's an issue here. And I guess I would argue that I'm not sure there's an issue, because what would become subsection 1, as you pointed out, has case law definitions of the term just compensation. But for subsection 2, proponents are providing their own definition, which I think you're accurate, it's a different definition. But they've limited it just to subsection 2. And if subsection 1 can use the term just compensation, it seems like proponents could use that term in the Constitution somewhere as well. And like I say, it seems like they could have a separate definition. And so, to me, there may be some confusion just about the fact that it's located in a section that already uses that term. That maybe adds to the confusion. I am a little concerned about the potential catchphrase or argument, because just is a judgment, but, it is a legal term. I can see why the proponents use it, and I'm not, there's this temptation just to recognize that that is a legal term and they're entitled to use it and entitled to defend it or define it somewhat differently. But having said all of that, I mean, maybe it's quite sufficient just to take the word just out of the titles. I'm not sure that we lose anything if we refer to requiring public entities to provide compensation to an owner. And it strikes me that maybe that just avoids the issue. I don't know that there's anything lost by that. Do you have any comment about simply taking it out? The word just, that is.
I think that helps measurably.
Okay. Your paragraph 4 about remedies, I'm not quite with you on that yet either. I'm not sure about the word. If there were a better word, I'd like to find it. But in the context of the titles, it's talking about providing remedies to owners for land use regulation that diminish the value of property. And there needs to be a term in order to describe a single subject. I mean, there's more than one thing that owners can do, but to avoid the appearance of stating multiple subjects, I think there needs to be a single term there. And I think the concept is it provides a method of addressing land use regulations that diminish the value of property. And remedy, I'm not sure, is inaccurate or misleading. It's something that addresses or fixes a situation. Fix, I'm not sure is the right word either, but if I had a better word, I'd be happy to use it. But I'm not sure that remedies is misleading or that it's prejudicial. But still trying to think that one through. Harder one, maybe jumping down to paragraph 7. I think I need some help understanding that as well. The titles fail to state that the measure applies to land use regulations that have been in effect since 1970. And I do just need to try to think that through a bit. The measure says that it does not apply to land use regulation that is enacted prior to 1970. And I think that's the key point that you're focusing on. I'm trying to figure out in my mind, trying to understand the measure on that point, because I am picturing the measure at this point as being prospective only in this respect. It doesn't apply to measures enacted prior to 1970, so I assume in theory it applies to measures enacted beginning in 1970 on, but that may mean only with respect to enforcing previously enacted land use regulation. And maybe where I need to start is at the beginning of subsection 2, because the you know that's what kicks all of this off. If any public entity enacts or enforces, in present tense, enacts or enforces. And I'm assuming that that could be, both of those could be read prospectively only. In other words, on or after the effective date of this measure, if a public entity enacts or enforces a land use regulation, et cetera, then this measure kicks in. So the relevance of the provision in paragraph A that it doesn't apply to measures enacted prior to 1970 is that something could have been enacted in 1971, for example, but it's never been enforced. And after the effective date of this measure, a public entity begins to enforce that. And therefore, this measure would apply to that situation. But it would not necessarily, and this is what I'm trying to figure out, would not necessarily apply to something that was enacted in 1971 by itself, perhaps if it's been consistently enforced ever since. But I don't know. I mean, that's, in other words, I'm not sure that this is that significant, that maybe this is just a detail, if it's prospective only. I think your argument is that this is very significant, that it is retrospective, and that it has to be mentioned in the titles. Is that accurate?
That's correct. I think if I could maybe advance that line of thought a little bit, under subsection 2B, Roman numeral 2, Roman numeral 1 talks about how the process works. You have to provide written demand. And then Roman numeral 2 talks about when written demand has to be made. It has to be made within 5 years of, and paragraph C is what's critical, the date the public entity seeks to enforce the land use regulation. So presumably, 5 years, any date 5 years prior to the passage of this measure in which a local entity has enforced the land use regulation at issue, there would be an outstanding claim under the amendment, either for compensation or exemption. And so it seems to me that it is not strictly prospective in nature. It anticipates actions that have already occurred, or it permits, put it that way, land use regulations that have already occurred. And then there's a whole process under Roman numeral 3 whereby there's a public entity response and paragraph 4 on down. But there's nothing in here which prevents, and I would suggest to you that in fact the goal of the measure is to permit the retroactive seeking of compensation for land use regulation enforcement that occurred within the last 5 years.
Well, and you may be right, but it still seems to me that there is a reading of it that's prospective only. That and I appreciate your pointing out the language there about written demand shall be made within 5 years, et cetera. But I'm still kind of bogged down in what really may be a matter of interpretation.
Well, I suppose if the proponents were to say that this not intended to apply to any land use action that occurred prior to the effective date of the measure, that would be something that there would be some reason to come to that conclusion. But based upon the text, that's not the way the text reads. And frankly, it seems to me that that is a relatively important aspect, that there are a series of land use measures across the state, across the spectrum of public entities that are going to be covered by this measure.
Let me see if I have any other questions about the motion for rehearing. But I don't think I do. Mr. Carden, do you have anything further for Mr. Gruskin?
No, I don't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do have one other person signed up, Scott Gessler, if you'd like to identify yourself and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Scott Gessler, and I represent the proponents in this matter. I'd be happy to respond to the motion for rehearing and perhaps address some of the board's questions that I heard earlier. Maybe to start at the very end, with respect to the very last point, I'm happy to explain exactly what the proponent's intent is with respect to the 1970 issue. Essentially, this provision would apply to land use regulations that were enacted and enforced after 1970, but prior to this amendment, but only to those owners who currently own it and continuously owned it at that time. So in other words, the way the proposal, we intend for it to be structured, is that this applies to all land use regulations that are enforced or that are enacted and enforced, and they have to be enacted or enforced either after 1970. I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. It shall all enforced or enacted land use regulations, but not any land use regulations that are enacted prior to 1970 or after 1970, but prior to the acquisition by an owner. So in other words, if you are an owner, if there's a land use regulation that went into effect in 1975 and an owner purchased the land in 1980, they would not have a cause of action under this because they did not own the land at the time that the land use regulation was enacted. If there is an owner who owns the land in 1975, and an enactment or a land use regulation is enacted in 1985, for example, and that owner owns it today or at the time they file, they would have a cause of action. If an owner owns a land in 1975, for example, the land use regulation goes into effect in 1985 and they sell it prior to this ballot measure passing, they would not have a cause of action. So in other words, it's a dual requirement. They have to have it. It is enacted after 1970, or to apply retroactively, it has to be enacted after 1970 and apply at that time to an owner who owned the land then and owns it today.
So I
guess my point with respect to that is, I'm certainly trying to explain the measure, but if respect to paragraph 7 on the motion for rehearing, if that were simply placed in, you know, since 1970, that would be misleading in itself because it's not all land use regulations since 1970, but only a small subset of land use regulations that apply to an owner that still owns that land today. Does that clarify?
I think that helps. Let me go over it again, though.
Okay.
So owner buys property in 1975. Land use regulation enacted in 1980. I mean, the owner has owned the land continuously and still does since 1975. Land use regulation enacted in 1980. Let's assume not enforced, that it becomes effective or they begin enforcing it in 1985. So the measure applies to that, except that written demand has to be made within 5 years of the date of enactment or the date that the entity seeks to enforce it. Does that foreclose the owner then because it's more than 5 years since then?
No, because it also includes the enactment of the measure, of this particular ballot measure. So in other words, the retroactivity provision will only apply for 5 years from the enactment of this measure. In other words, if you look at paragraph 2BC, I'm sorry, paragraph 2B, Roman 2, it says written demand shall be made within 5 years of, and the very first one is the effective date of this measure. I think you were just concentrating on either the date of the enactment or the date of enforcement.
Well, but, I mean, for the next 5 years, someone can make a written demand, but my hypothetical was assuming that they could, except that it has to be within 5 years of all of those things, and although it would be within 5 years of the effective date of the measure, it wouldn't be within 5 days of the date of the enactment or within 5 days of the date that the public entity seeks to enforce the land use regulation.
I mean, our intent, and I'm happy to state this for the record, is that it's within 5 years of any one of those three items. And we use the
And it is or. You're correct.
Disjunctive or rather than conjunctive and.
Okay.
So, and just to clarify, one other point is that the land use, the owner has to own the land when it's, the land use regulation is enacted after 1970, not merely enforced, but enacted after 1970.
Mr. Carton?
Mr. Gessler, item 10 of Mr. Gruskin's motion for rehearing says the titles fail to refer to the only process by which an exception listed under 8 above is established, namely that such exception is found by a court of law. Is that accurate?
I would argue that that's not inaccurate. Both numbers 9 and 10, we believe, do not accurately reflect what the measure does. I'm happy to explain with respect to number 10. Where it says the titles fail to refer to the only process by which an exception listed under 8 above is established, namely that such exception is found by a court of law and such finding cannot be further appealed. With respect to the finding by the court of law, the point is that, yes, it is a court of law that makes that finding because it's a legal process. Secondly, that the finding cannot be further appealed. We believe that that it can be appealed, but rather that it sets a, it's a, yeah, if you look at 2B7, Romans 7, I'm sorry, Romans 6, because all exceptions shall be narrowly construed, shall be proven by the public entity by clear and convincing evidence. Okay, it says a public entity's determination shall be insufficient to establish an exception contained in subsection 2A12. All that that means is that a public entity cannot simply state, we hereby find X, and that that is sufficient evidence to overcome their burden of proof. They actually have to provide proof that they have met the exception.
Do they have to?
A court of law.
So they have to prove it in a court.
Exactly. They have to prove it in a court of law. And I would simply argue that this is like any other civil action that exists in our state. It has to be proved in a court of law.
So 10 is accurate?
10 is accurate to the extent that the exception has to be found by a court of law, but it's inaccurate with respect to saying, and such finding cannot be further appealed. Rather, it says it shall be subject to de novo review upon appeal. So basically, it allows the appellate court to engage in de novo appeal, right, rather than an abuse of discretion standard for appeal. So it definitely can be appealed. There's no doubt of that. It simply sets forth a standard for that appeal of that particular finding.
Thank you.
And it seems to me that, I mean, the way, with respect to item number 9, it struck me that that was somewhat inaccurate because the exceptions may be established by a public entity engaged in land use regulation, but only if they go to a court and establish it through that process. They can't unilaterally establish
Correct.
The exceptions.
Correct. For example, the General Assembly regularly includes a safety clause that such legislation is necessary for the public safety, health, and welfare. The concern here is that public entities would merely say, this exception is necessary, this land use regulation is necessary to protect the public health and safety, in other words. They are certainly welcome to say that, but they must prove that it is intended to protect the public health and safety, or it's intended to comply with federal law, or that it's simply restricts or prohibits activities historically recognized as nuisances under common law. I mean, they can say that, but they still have to prove it in a court of law. So they're certainly able to establish it. So yes, that's why I believe 9 and 10 would be inaccurate.
Let me ask you a couple of other questions about the arguments advanced by Mr. Gruskin. And Ms. Gomez, maybe you could put the titles on, project them on the screen just so everyone can see the titles. I'm wondering about a couple of the things that Mr. Gruskin has raised. For example, number one seems to have his objection number one, or concerning number one, is that perhaps the title should reflect, I think it's 1, 2, 3, fourth line down, if a public entity enacts or enforces land use regulations, et cetera.
I don't often find myself in this position, but I would agree with Mr. Gruskin and have no objection to including the term enforces as well.
Then with respect to number 2 and 3, paragraph 2 and 3 of the motion for rehearing, as I indicated to Mr. Gruskin, I'm not quite sure that I agree with the arguments, but it seemed like it would be easy just to take the word just out and refer to public entities to provide compensation to an owner, et cetera. Would you have any objection to just taking the word just out?
I don't. I would also propose as well using the phrase saying a public entity, and I think this would be accurate, shall pay fair market value. Fair market value is used in the definition of just compensation by the statute as well. And I think it's well defined in law to be the price that a willing buyer will pay to a willing seller through an arm's length transaction. So it's a well recognized definition. It would not be misleading, it would be accurate, specifically used in the initiative itself.
But it what's actually is paid is the diminution in fair market value, isn't it? Not just fair market value, but
correct. So by just compensation, or so rather than saying to provide just compensation, to pay the fair market value of the diminution to an owner. So I would agree with you.
Or reduction in fair market value. I'm a little concerned about the term. I'm not sure I even can say it right. Diminution.
Reduction works fine. As well. the reduction in fair market value.
Okay. Mr. Carton.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say, as far as 2 and 3 go, I appreciate Mr. Gruskin's arguments and Mr. Gessler's amenability to going along with that change, and I'm not going to – I wouldn't object to striking just and making it compensation. I would say, though, that I don't think that use of the term just compensation is necessarily misleading. In the context of the measure and given the fact that it's creating new language, and I don't think it's necessarily a catchphrase. I note that it's used in the text, that term, that phrase is used at least 7 times besides the definition, and so I think it's a term that's integral to the measure, but so long as Mr. Gessler doesn't object, I won't make his argument for him.
My strong preference would be to stay with the language of the initiative, and that's why I was willing to. I'm happy to propose using the term fair market value of the reduction or of the diminution, because I think that gets to the essential central tenet of what's going on, is that the value that's normally paid on the market, fair transaction between buyer and seller, that's the standard by which this is judged. So, and simply for the record, again, I'm not falling on my sword on this, but for the record, I would argue that just compensation is not a catchphrase, that it does accurately reflect a legal standard that's been developed by courts to provide compensation to private individuals and private entities when a governmental entity exercises takings under the Fifth Amendment. The government is required to pay just compensation. So I think that's a pretty standard legal term of art. I actually did look it up in Black's Law Dictionary before I came here and would stand on that. And I think that essentially what this is getting at, this entire initiative, is the whole issue of a regulatory taking, which in some instances is recognized under the Fifth Amendment when the diminution reaches a certain threshold, approaching 100%, then just compensation will be paid under a normal constitutional legal standard.
Chairman, would it be appropriate to move to make those changes right now as we're going along?
Sure.
And on the staff draft,
actually on the title set by the board.
Yeah, that's correct. The title. I would move that in the line, the fourth line at the very end where it says public entity enacts, after enacts, I would move that the words "or enforces" be inserted.
I'll second that. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Mr. Cardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the third line at the very end, provide just, strike the word just. The third line down, Ceci, strike the word just. I think that's the only.
I'll second that. Any discussion? Again, I only have Mr. Gruskin and Mr. Gessler signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the motion for rehearing? Seeing none, the motion is to strike the word just at the end of line 3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Any other suggested changes to the titles? Mr. Cardin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. We'll work hard not to repeat anything you've already said. I do want to say on paragraph 4 of the motion, where it says remedies, the objection is that remedies in the introductory clause of the titles is not found in the initiative text and is prejudicial. And when I went back and looked at the measure, I wanted to make sure that there were remedies. And I guess this is a quick opportunity to ask you, Mr. Gessler, are the remedies in the measure the compensation or the enjoining of a land use regulation, or is there only one? What would you characterize as the remedies?
I think the remedies are the compensation at fair market value or enjoining. And of course, a landowner does not have to seek those remedies. If a landowner does nothing, the land use regulation won't be in effect. So I think they're properly characterized as remedies, seeking to change the status quo. And just very briefly, I would argue that the title board certainly has authority to include words that don't necessarily appear in the title itself. I won't read the entire name of the case, but simply cite at 646 Pacific 2nd 916, Colorado Supreme Court, involving a title pertaining to the sale of table wine in grocery stores. So I think there's ample court authority to say that the title board can use words that don't necessarily appear within the text, but are used to place the initiative within context and make it understandable.
And my thinking, Mr. Chairman, was that it seemed to me that one way to address that, if the board wanted to do it, and I'm not completely sold on it, is to do a broadening of the title to where, rather than referencing the remedies, you had language to the effect that was concerning land use regulation of public entities that diminish the value of privately owned real property. I would just put that out there for consideration. There would be no reference to the remedies, but you would, in the language that follows the true title, you would have the language about providing compensation and exempting. And so there would be language in the title that specified what the remedy was, but the true title to the measure, the language preceding the any connection therewith, would take more of a broader brush. That might be one way to address that. I put that for your consideration.
So again, that would be concerning, did you say, land use regulations that diminish the value of
privately owned real property.
Gessler, any comment about that?
We think that the use of the word remedies is accurate. I'm not exactly sure, and I apologize if I didn't pick up on when Mr. Gruskin said it, because I arrived a little bit late, exactly how this is viewed as prejudicial. I think the actual standard is it misleading, is it inaccurate, Or does it create a catchphrase? Now, the use of the word prejudicial I don't think is necessarily standard. I don't think it's misleading. I don't think it's accurate. And I certainly don't see how it creates a catchphrase by using that word. It's inaccurate in the sense that it does provide a remedy for an owner who's subject to land use regulations that diminish the value of their property more than 20%. It's absolutely accurate in what it does. It doesn't mislead the public, and it does not create a catchphrase, but although I'm willing to how it may and respond to that.
I must confess I can't remember the particulars of the argument, so
Well, and I'm not going to speak for Mr. Gruskin, although I think he referred to legal remedies, and I think that was, it seems to me that the measure does provide two legal remedies in circumstances where there are land use regulations that diminish the value of property, and it does seem accurate to me. On the one hand, I appreciate suggestion of Mr. Carton if it resolves the problem, but also something is lost as well by removing the concept that the measure provides legal remedies for that circumstance. So,
and I guess I concur with that, and I just wanted to raise that suggestion, and I would withdraw it. And then, as far as items 5 and 6 go. I think that I am more or less of the same mind as you, Mr. Chairman, on these, although I think that it's a good discussion. My simplistic take on objections 5 and 6, I guess, is that while I appreciate that use of the terms public entity and land use regulation may be expansive, may impact the interpretation of that terminology based on Supreme Court decisions and on local control and those kinds of things that Mr. Gruskin articulated. I think to somehow, I'm not sure how or if it's the title board's responsibility, given the relevant line of cases, to somehow convey that in the title of the measure. I'm thinking that both 5 and 6 may be subject to debate, may be an interpretation, and that I guess I'm reluctant to try and work out, or I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think that the relevant authority requires us to go forward and incorporate that in the title, and so I wouldn't have any suggested changes on 5 and 6. And then I'm going to jump over 7. And I guess as far as 8, 9, and 10 go, and I'll just cut to the chase, there may be a way, and it may be appropriate, and I guess I'd be interested in, well, I'd like to hear what Mr. Gessler thinks, of going ahead and addressing 8, 9, and 10. And at least 9 and 10, I think, may be able, you could maybe resolve those in one additional line to the current language of the title. And may, in fact, number 7 as well. And I'm thinking too that may be consistent with some of the case law in this area. My suggested language for your consideration, Mr. Chairman, is accepting would be additional language at the end of the current title that was to the effect accepting certain land use regulations based on the date of enactment, which would try to address the 1970 date without specifically stating it, or if the regulations are found by a court to be necessary to prevent nuisances protect the public health and safety, or comply with federal law. In other words, somehow these objections that are found in 7, 8, 9, and 10, there may be a way to incorporate those into the measure. And I guess my question to you, Mr. Gessler, is are you supportive of that? Or
I'd like to take a look at it, see actually how it's written first, but my initial reaction is I don't have an objection to that.
I'm not sure that I see it as significant enough to amend the titles. I'm trying to balance the fact on the one hand the board is required to have titles that are brief and state the major features, and here on the other hand we don't want to leave out anything significant. The question is, are the exceptions, how significant are the exceptions? There are exceptions to the general rule stated in the titles. Those exceptions relating to public health and safety, comply with federal law, nuisances. Not sure that any of them surprise. One of the tests is to what extent would people be surprised or misled by not including something in the titles about those exceptions, and not quite convinced that there would be something that would rise to that level, but Mr. Gessler?
I'd be happy to respond to that. I think my initial support is based on the fact that I'd like to move forward with the process so that we can begin collecting signatures. That said, there's pretty clear case law that the title board need not include all exceptions. Not include exceptions to the general concepts that are related. The question really becomes, would it otherwise be misleading if the court or if the title board were to fail to include those exceptions? I don't think as it is now it's misleading. That said, I recognize that the title board wants to keep things brief and avoid undue complexity. So I recognize that it's wrestling with that trade-off here. Apologize, I'm not taking a strong stand to help the board one way or the other.
That doesn't seem to be finding support with you, then I wouldn't. That's all that I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Griskin, do you have anything further? I didn't give you a chance to kind of respond to Mr. Gessler, but if you have anything that you wanted to advise the board about, having heard Mr. Gessler.
It seems to me that the proponent's discussion of the retroactivity was a useful one. It brought into, for me anyway, some high relief that this provision as written does apply to provisions that are already on the books and that have been on the books for quite a while. And I just want to clarify, and I think it was a statement that you made, Mr. Chair, that the written demand provision relating to the 5 years, because as Mr. Gessler pointed out, these are all ors, that a public entity that seeks to enforce a land use regulation, so therefore something that's been on the books for 5 years, an enforcement action in the year 2010 of a land use regulation that was enacted in 1980 is the subject of a claim until the year 2015. And just so it's understood here, there are no limitations, except as set forth by Mr. Gessler, the ownership can't have changed. But there's no limitation in terms of looking back on those regulations. And I would like to think that the language enacts or enforces is broad enough, but it doesn't connote any retroactivity. Enact suggests a present act. Enforce is broad enough to also be prospective as to an enactment, but it doesn't even imply that there are regulations enacted 36 years ago that will be covered by this measure. I think the title ought to address that retroactivity. That's the only thing I'd add to the discussion.
Thank you. And I just, in response, I think Mr. Gessler's comments do indicate that this is more significant, frankly, than I was appreciating before Mr. Gruskin raised the issue. I'm still not sure I actually can conclude what to say about the retrospectivity. If I had a clear picture of what the board can say in the titles, but there's a certain amount of legal interpretation there that I'm reluctant to make, even though it is apparent there is some kind of retrospectivity there that may be more than I appreciated. I just don't know, once we get into that, how to accurately make that call in a fair way in the title. I don't know, Mr. Gessler, if you have a suggestion on that, I'm open to it, but because that is, you know, something that does bother me to the extent that it may be a significant effect of the measure. Like I say, I just, without being able to interpret the measure more thoroughly, I just don't know that I have any language to offer at this point. Mr. Gessler, do you have a comment?
I don't have any specific answers, but I will make two comments. One is that it doesn't apply to all regulations, land use regulations, and I'd argue that it's far narrower than that initial glance. And the reason why it's far narrower is that it only applies to an owner, defined in this, the owner's family member, the owner that owned the land at the time that land use regulation was enacted. So it's not any land use regulation that applies to any land, but only certain land under continuous ownership since the time prior to the initiative, after 1970, and was owned at the time it was enacted. So there, sort of the sense is that the owner is entitled to benefit from the investment-backed expectations of what that land will bring at the time they purchased it. So there's a land use regulation in effect, and an owner sells it tomorrow, the new owner cannot afford himself with this cause of action. So that's the first thing. The second one would be an empirical one, and I recognize that my empirical statement may not be entirely accurate, but it's the best I have to offer. My understanding is that there was an Oregon initiative that was passed, later struck down, then later the court reversed, that applied to all land use regulations. It did not have the 1970 limitation. It did have the continuous ownership limitation. Statewide, I think it had a one-year statute of limitations, perhaps two. But in the first year, approximately, there were, I think, 143 claims statewide in Oregon based on that statute. So my point is that, from an empirical standpoint, I don't think it's necessarily that significant. The actual exception as well, because it's so limited based on that continuous ownership provision, that as well would limit the significance of it.
Thank you. Any other discussion by the board or suggested changes to the titles previously adopted by the board? I don't think I do either. So I believe a motion would be in order.
I move to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent of the changes made adopted by the title board.
I'll second that. And the understanding, of course, is that the changes made in the ballot title With the same changes to be made in the ballot title and submission clause, which is exactly the same except in the form of a question. That's been moved and seconded. Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. That concludes action on number 86, and the time is 3:02 p.m. Take a brief recess. Are there representatives here of number 80? They are here? Okay. Thanks.
We'll do that one next.
Thing that's happening here, I think it's
abortion.
Yeah, they're here.
Pretty well for not listening.
Yeah.
It's experience. desk.
It wouldn't be out until
He said January. Oh, wait, because they get to